How's everybody doing today? The weekend of March 29 and 30 will forever be known as the weekend where we dedicated 900 children at Riverview Church. Unbelievable. I love their faces. And the little kids' faces, too, are fun to watch. I tried to figure out how I could get your attention here today. I thought about maybe a conversation about green and blue or something like that. It's a big day, but I thought instead what we'd do is do a little test. By the way, my name is James. I'm one of the pastors here at Riv. And as you have been, I've been following along in this Genesis series and recently the life of Joseph. And so just to see how well you've been paying attention, I'm going to just kind of quiz you a little bit. You can write down the answers on your tear-off. There's pens in the seats in front of you. Or you can just remember what you thought the answer was in your head. We're using the honor code here. If you cheat on the Joseph test at church, you've failed the test, okay? All right, so the first question, how old was Joseph when he had the two dreams about his brothers and his parents bowing down to him? Now, don't yell out the answer. Somebody did that last night. That ruins it for everybody else. How old was Joseph? Second question, what story did Joseph's brothers tell their father Jacob about how Joseph had died? Although he did not die, but they told him a story about him dying. What was the story? Question three, what was the name of the captain of the guard who bought Joseph as a slave and had him as a slave in his house in Egypt? And then the last question, now this is for you overachievers. If anyone gets this right, you're really paying attention. What new name did Pharaoh give Joseph after Joseph interpreted his dreams and then was put in charge of the land of Egypt? The Pharaoh gave him, and if you can get bonus points if you remember what the meaning of that name was, all right? All right, let's see how you did. Question number one, how old was Joseph? He was 17 years old when he had those dreams. His brothers, the second answer was that he was killed by a fierce animal, okay? And you can get half credit if you mention Donny Osmond and the Technicolor Dreamcoat in that answer. Third one, the captain of the guard, his name was Potiphar. Very good. The new name that Joseph was given was Zaphnath-Paneah, of course, obviously. And that means God speaks, or God speaks and lives, or it's related to, anyway, if you got that, how many of you got all four? Anybody? Three? You could have done very well. Nice job. If you're feeling like you're needed to lie or cheat on the test, then you can deal with that later. Life is full of tests, right? We grow up. And we're faced with, right away, I mean, we have blood tests, and then you maybe take a swim test, and then you take tests in school, and the ACT, and your driver's certification test, and your MCAT, and your pregnancy test. There's all kinds of tests that you can end up taking. A test, there's two definitions. I think both are helpful. The first one is it's a set of questions or problems used as a means of evaluating the aptitudes, skills, or performance of an individual. Kind of like the test I just gave you. It measures what you know or what you can remember or sometimes what you can do. Okay? The second definition there is different. The means by which the presence, quality, or genuineness of anything is determined, or anyone is determined. Think chemistry. You have the test tube, and they put the stuff in it. You're trying to figure out, what is this? What is it made of? Is it pure? What's inside of it? And the same idea when it comes to testing with people. The test here reveals who you are, your quality, your genuineness, your character as a person. Now, the question often gets asked, do tests reveal ability and character, or do they develop ability and character? And I think it can be both. I mean, by definition, it's more on the reveal side, that you're determining what's already true about someone. What we're going to see in addition as we study through the story today is that tests are often a tool in God's hands that he uses to forge character in people as well. And so as we walk through the story today, we're going to see both dynamics at work in the life of Joseph. We're going to start in Genesis chapter 42 and verse 3. So if you have your Bible, you can flip open to that spot. We're also going to throw the verses up on the screen, or you can follow along. If you have a web-enabled device, you can do it that way as well. So this is Genesis chapter 42, verse 3. It says, "So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob," he's their father, "did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Thus the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan." The land of Canaan is Israel, where Jacob's family was from. "Now Joseph was the governor over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people in the land." Now, at the end of that story, that little verse there, the idea Joseph has become the governor, or as Noel referenced last week, the COO of earth. He's got the biggest responsibility in the most powerful country in the world. And you see in the story, the famine has spread throughout the world to the point where everybody who wants food has to come and see Joseph from all over the world. And Joseph got to this position through a series of tests. He was betrayed, and then he was enslaved, and then he was promoted, and then he was seduced, and then he was demoted, and then he was put before Pharaoh, and he's interpreting dreams, and it's up and down, and all these different things. And throughout it all, his character remained consistent. Joseph trusted God. He faithfully exercised his gifts for God, and he gave all credit to God. And the tests keep coming, right? Let's talk about famine for a moment. We can't blow past that. Think about the hungriest you've ever been in your life. My friend Lauren calls it when you get hangry. You're so hungry, you're just angry, right? Imagine that ache in your stomach all day, every day, and there's no relief in sight. The rain is not coming. The crops are not growing. And you have children that are starving. Did you realize that over 20,000 people die of starvation or hunger-related issues in our world every day? That's one every 4 or 5 seconds. And most of them are children. We need to feel that. This is what's going on with Joseph. In Genesis 42, Joseph is 37 years old, and he is a tested leader. This might be his biggest test. And what I love about this as well is that God positions his servant Joseph to save. His sovereign plan throughout has been to navigate Joseph's life so that when the world reached the point where he was needed most to be in this position, God had moved him in an unlikely way to that spot. And I want us to be thinking, as we think through the tests that we go through in our lives, as we're processing through that, that we would just be praying. I'm not sure why or what's going on here, God, but please use whatever it is, circle it back so that more might be saved down the road. That's kind of what happens with Joseph here. People all over the world are starving, and their only hope is to come to Joseph to get fed. Now, the test is bigger than that for Joseph, because on top of all that, his family re-enters the story. 20 years since he hasn't seen his brothers, and now they show up in front of him. I don't know if you've ever, you know, when you go visit your family and all the weirdness sometimes that goes with that. And, I mean, this is just beyond. I mean, the circumstances. Watch how Joseph responds. Verse 6, "And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them." Where do you come from? I don't have a rough voice. "Where do you come from?" he said. And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." And Joseph recognized his brothers, But they did not recognize him. He's 20 years in the Egyptian culture. He's changed his look. They aren't expecting it to be him. They have no idea that it's him. But he sees them, and immediately the 10 guys, and he's grown up with these guys, he realizes that this is who these guys are. Now, here we see the two sets of dreams collide, right? The dream that Joseph had interpreted for Pharaoh, the one about the coming famine, it had come to pass. They are now in the season of famine. Because of that, his brothers are now coming to get food, and they bow before Joseph, which is the fulfillment of the dream that Joseph himself had had. Now, if you're Joseph, how do you respond when you see your 10 brothers for the first time in 20 years, you know, the ones who had betrayed you, thrown you into the pit, lied to your father about being dead, all of that kind of stuff? I mean, is it just like you forget all that and it's an emotional reunion and there's weeping and you reconnect? Maybe, or maybe it's the pendulum swing the whole other way where you're like, let's just send these guys to prison and cut their heads off and I'm in power now. Or is it like dream trash talking where you're like, I told you, you guys should listen to my dream, and you're just kind of an I told you so moment? No. Joseph acts like he doesn't know them. There's no sign of recognition. Now, when I first read through this, I thought that Joseph was just being vindictive, right? He was going to use his power to just get back at these guys, to get revenge, to kind of string them along. And he has this, in his DNA, they have this sort of family gift of deception. And he was going to use that to just sort of be a jerk to his brothers. And maybe rightfully so. But I think something else is going on here. And the reason I think that is because prior to this, Joseph's character is so consistent that I began to dig deeper and I discovered that I really think that there's more to the story than just that. Verse 9, it says, "And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them." Now, remember the second dream back in chapter 37, there was 11 stars and the sun and the moon that came and bowed before him. What does Joseph see in front of him now? 10 stars. And so I think Joseph is aware, okay, there's more that God is going to do to unfold his plan here. Not everything I saw has been fulfilled. And he said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." He accuses them of being there to spy and find the weakness in Egypt. Now that they have this famine, maybe somebody would come and try to attack them. Their response was great. "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men." I love that. They just lie about being honest right there. "And your servants have never been spies." Joseph is, 20 years of a group lie is why he's there. I mean, it's the whole thing is, are they honest men? They're not spies. Joseph's response, verse 15, he says, "By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your younger brother comes here. You got to bring Benjamin back to me. Send one of you and let him bring your brother." And actually, he flips the plan around. He ends up letting them send all of them, and one guy stays, Simeon. We're going to see that here in a second. "While you remain confined, that your words may be tested whether there is truth in you." And so instead of welcoming his brothers or rebuking them, Joseph decides to test them. Now, I was talking with somebody in the lobby. Really interesting to think about, is he stepping in again for a role that really Jacob should be playing? The father. And the brothers consistently are rising to different leadership positions. I don't know, but specifically what it says here is that Joseph is going to test their words to see if they're telling the truth. Are they being truthful? He knows from personal experience that the people in his family, their default mode when things get difficult is to lie. and to deceive. It's the habit of their lives. It's the way they've disciplined themselves. They just automatically respond that way. And it's a destructive pattern. Now, let me step out of the text for a moment and ask you this question. Are you a truth teller? I mean, really. How would you like to be put to test in this area of your life? This idea of examining one's life or having one's life examined by others, by God, it's all over the Bible. I was surprised. I knew of a few instances, but as I began to study it, I'm going to give you a couple of many, many examples where this idea of testing is shown as very, very important and commonplace. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, it says, "Examine yourselves to see whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Search your heart. Is Jesus in my heart?" 1 Thessalonians 2:4, Paul, on behalf of Timothy and Silvanus, he says, "We have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak not to please men, but to please God who tests our hearts." The God of the universe knows our hearts, the motivation, the movement, the intent of our hearts, the genuineness, and he's in the process sometimes of testing what's going on in our hearts. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 10 says, "And let them be tested first." The "them" he's talking about actually in this passage is deacons. I think you could apply this idea with elders or other leadership positions. "Let them be tested first, then let them serve as deacons if they prove themselves blameless." If you're going to move into a significant leadership position, this is humans saying to other humans, "You know what, I'm going to put you through a time of testing first." And really the specific here is to prove yourself blameless, but depending on what situation, there might be other pre-tests involved, but that's seen here in 1 Timothy 3. And then in 1 Timothy 4, the whole chapter there would be useful to read. Paul's instruction to Timothy, one little section where he says, "Keep close watch on yourself," I'm sorry, on your life and your teaching. And the words he uses there, he talks about practicing and preparing and being diligent and being persistent in this. It's this constant sort of evaluation. The idea there being, be ready for the test. I don't know if you've ever walked into a class and they're handing out tests and you didn't even realize there was going to be a test that day. Ever had that happen to you? Some of us live our lives all the time like that, just unprepared, not thinking that this might be coming. Paul says to Timothy, no, you need to live a prepared life. Testing is commonplace and important in the Bible. Jesus, by the way, was frequently tested. Go back and read your Gospels. The scribes and Pharisees would come up to him all the time, and it says they would test him with questions. They wanted to see, is he authentic and biblical in the way he lives? And of course, Jesus just blew him out of the water every time, but it was part of his life as well. Why? James chapter 1 gives us one of the reasons. In verse 2, it says, "Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds." These tests, they come in all shapes and sizes, right? Here's the why. "For you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance." Endurance is strength over time. You're able to do more for longer without wavering. It's an increase of strength. The testing of your faith, in other words, your willingness to walk out into what you say you believe, is tested all the time. And as you work through those challenges successfully, it builds strength and character inside of you. Then he says, "And let that endurance have its full effect as you get stronger, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." Now, as I said, these tests all, you know, can be different. Just the people that were standing up here on the stage, right? Often it's just life normally happening And there's your test right there. I mean, when you have your first child or your second or third, however many, every one, every single day, you're stretching. It's just, I mean, it just feels like that. You're trying to take a test that you haven't studied for. That's what it feels like, that parenting process all of the time, right? Pastor Craig Barnes said, "I have yet to meet an adult who is living the life he or she planned." Life is challenging. And because of that, internal change should be normal and welcome in our lives. But sometimes that's difficult because tests are hard. Change is hard. You know, my own season right now in my life, it's a season of testing. And I can't tell you all the details, but one of the things that's really been a challenge has been my wife's mother passed away pretty suddenly recently. And it's been really a challenge for her, for my boys. That's their Grammy, as they've been dealing through that. And I'm being stretched huge in as a husband, as a father. There's other things going on in my life. I'm being stretched as a leader. It's this season, and it's a lot of, it's exhausting. It's been hard, but it's been good. And my prayer this week, even as I've been thinking through, and as God, circle this back around, I don't see it right now, but for your glory, that someday it would result in more and more people getting saved. Joseph faced massive tests, and he endured, and his endurance grew. And I think what happens here is he wants to see that in the lives of his brothers as well. And so he says, "I'm going to test you." Here's their response, Genesis chapter 42, verse 21. "Then they said to one another, 'In truth,'" and I love that that's their first response, because what's Joseph's aim to test their truthfulness? "If we're being honest, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen. This is why distress has come upon us." Now, it's interesting that one of the things that often happens when we're tested, and I think this is God's purpose sometimes, is to dig out sin in our lives. I mean, the situation that they're going through has very little to do with this thing for years ago, but immediately it raises this conviction inside of them from long ago of, if we are just being truth tellers, we blew it. And it adds something to the story that we didn't see before, that apparently Joseph had begged them for mercy and they had ignored him. They did not listen. In John 15, Jesus calls this pruning, which sounds like, oh, it's a little gardening and everything. No, it's when you cut off, right, something that's harmful or dying, that's part of a living thing, in order that the whole thing can be fruitful or more fruitful. The brothers are convicted. Sometimes the purpose of the test is to draw that to the surface. Reuben, even more so. Watch his response. "And Reuben answered them, 'Did I not tell you not to sin against the boy?'" What did I tell you? Now, I often wonder if Reuben, whenever he would say stuff and get these discussions, if the brothers would be like, "Yeah, but didn't you sleep with mom, Reuben? I don't know where, well, you don't have a leg to stand on." That really happened, by the way. And is Reuben innocent in this whole thing? He's acting like it, right? Sometimes what happens is the test in our response, our sinfulness bubbles to the surface. Reuben is defensive and self-righteous here. "You did not listen, and now there comes a reckoning or an accounting for his blood." Now, Reuben did try to protect Joseph. In fact, I think he might have saved Joseph's life if you go back and read the story. But he has been complicit in the lie to their father all along, just like the rest of the brothers. And I think this test revealed in him this sort of, well, I might have done the wrong, but it's not as this comparison kind of idea, a little bit of hypocrisy. Tests can do that. They were talking about this together in verse 23. It says, they did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. Joseph had been using an interpreter even though he didn't need one, so that they wouldn't know that he knew. Then he turned away from them, Joseph, and he wept. First of three times that Joseph weeps during this process. And then he kind of gathered himself, he returned to them, he talked with them, and then he grabbed Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. And Simeon is taken off to prison while his brothers head back to Israel to get Benjamin. And this is the first in a series of tests where they come from Israel to Egypt to buy food, and then they go back to Israel to get Benjamin, and then they end up having to bring him back to Egypt, and then they go back, and it's just this crazy, we don't have time to cover all the details, but it's a lot of walking, it's a lot of stretching. The issue here is that Jacob loves Benjamin so much, and he's so protective that these instructions from Joseph are really challenging. And their temptation to lie when they go back to their dad, or when they go back to Joseph, or when they go back to their dad, every single time, you can see in the story they're wrestling, they're asking, what shall we do? What is God doing here with this? And whereas in previous similar situations, they would have lied, if you read the story, you see that here they don't. They're honest. The testing of their faith is producing an enduring truthfulness. And we're going to see this here in a moment, specifically in Judah, one of the brothers. Now, through it all, Jacob is still more than reluctant. He's just totally opposed to the idea, right, of sending his youngest son, Benjamin. He's already lost Joseph in his mind, right? I'm not sending Benjamin back. But if you know the story, what happens is they run out of food again. And their whole clan is in trouble. The famine is huge. And so he, with Judah's help, agrees to send Benjamin back with them. And the visit goes smoothly. Joseph treats them well. What they didn't realize in chapter 44 is that Joseph was going to give them one final test. Verse 1, then he, Joseph, commanded the steward of his house. He said, fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. Just oversupply these guys. And put my cup, the silver cup. Apparently this was like the Stanley Cup or something. This is the cup. In the mouth of the sack of the youngest, with his money for the grain. They're on their way home. You got to imagine this picture, right? The brothers. They are so fired up. They've got the food. They've got Benjamin. Jacob is going to be happy. Our families are going to survive. And then they hear this voice calling from behind in the distance. And they look and they see, and there's a guy like running fast toward them. And so when the guy catches up, they realize this is Joseph's steward, and he's out of breath, and he says, look, I need to check your bags. Joseph's silver cup, the silver cup, is missing, which of course the guy knows where it is. He put it in Benjamin's bag. And so if you read the story, they get indignant about it. They're like, how dare you? I mean, we've been honest throughout this whole process. And as they're in the middle of this argument, out of Benjamin's bag, he pulls this cup. And they're tearing their clothes, and so they have to turn around and go back to Egypt to face Joseph one more time. And this is where Judah speaks on behalf of his brothers. Now remember Judah, chapter 37, it's Judah's idea to sell Joseph into slavery. Chapter 38 is all about Judah. That's the part where he sleeps with his daughter-in-law, but his excuse was that he thought she was a prostitute. Either way, his character doesn't look good in the story. Judah was immature. Judah was all about Judah. And then Joseph starts putting them to the test. And through this process, we witness a maturing in Judah. Even though he's the fourth oldest of the sons, the text begins to refer to them as Judah and his brothers. He starts to step forward. He begins to speak boldly, speak truthfully. He begins to lead. The testing of his faith is producing enduring character. In fact, he had made this promise, chapter 43, verse 8, to his father about Benjamin. He said, "Send the boy with me." This is when Jacob was reluctant to let Benjamin go back, and they were starving. "Send the boy with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones." It's often easy to forget their whole families were involved with this crisis. "I will be a pledge of his safety. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, let me bear the blame forever." That's a different Judah. He's taking responsibility. He's moving himself out of the center of the story. There's a lot of "we" in that passage. He responds differently to this test than we've seen in earlier similar situations. And I think that's a good barometer for us as well. When you face a difficult challenge, do you handle it the same way that you've done previously? Or is your level of patience growing? Your honesty, your grace, your wisdom. Judah is maturing, and now he stands in front of Joseph with his little brother, Benjamin, by his side with the silver cup. He's been caught thinking about Jacob, thinking about the whole situation. And what he says, it's really awesome in verse 30 of chapter 44. He says, "Now therefore, as soon as I come to your servant, my father, and as soon as I go back home to Jacob, and the boy, Benjamin, is not with us, then as his life," Jacob's life, "is bound up in Benjamin's life," he's just consumed by his son Benjamin, "as soon as he sees that the boy is not with us, he will die." He's going to fall over dead. He will not be able to handle it. "Your servants, me and my brothers, will bring his gray hairs with sorrow down to Sheol. For I," he says, "became a pledge of safety for the boy, for Benjamin, to my father. I said to him, if I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all my life." And then he says this in verse 33. "Now therefore, please let me remain instead of the boy, and I'll be your slave. I'll be a servant to you, my Lord, and let the boy go back with his brothers." Judah has changed. Whereas once it was all about him, now he's ready to give his life. "Substitute me for Benjamin. I'll become a slave so that he can be free to go home to his father." And in doing this, Judah gives us a glimpse of Jesus. We, as slaves to sin, and Jesus becoming our substitute on the cross so that we could be free to go home to God our Father. Now, how do we apply this story to our lives? There's a lot here. Let's do one more test. This one's easier. All you need to be able to do is draw or imagine a straight line, okay? If you're a note taker, you can write it down, or we'll put one up on the screen for you. Just put the word "self" at one side of the line and "sacrifice" at the other side of the line. And I just want you to think about yourself. Don't draw on other people's lines, just your own, right? The way you think, the decisions you make, the way you speak in your life in general, which tends to be more of your default? Is it more about you, or are you more about sacrificial living? Our mission here at Riverview is to make sacrificial followers of Jesus Christ who grow, serve, and go. And by sacrifice, we mean people who will lay down their lives for others, for the gospel, as Jesus has done for us. How are you doing with that mindset? How does a person move from self to sacrifice? Let's learn from Joseph one more time. Watch his response to Judah's plea in chapter 45. In verse 1, it says, "Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He just broke down. He cried, 'Make everyone go out for me.' And so no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. He wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard it." He's this cry that's so loud, it's just echoing through the corridors of the palace. "And Jacob said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?' But his brothers could not answer him." They were speechless, for they were dismayed at his presence. They were ashamed. They were broken. They couldn't even say a word. Now watch Joseph's response. And if you're nursing a grudge towards someone, or if you're struggling with unforgiveness, watch Joseph here. Verse 4. "Joseph said to his brothers, 'Come near to me, please.'" I picture him with his hand on the shoulder. "And now, I am your brother Joseph," he said, "whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God." The first step towards sacrificial living is to trust God. Joseph believes that God is in control. He trusts that God's plan is the best, rather than holding on to bitterness toward his brothers, which could have been justified. He extends this unusual, uncommon grace. He embraces their actions. Think about that. He embraces their actions as part of God's sovereign plan to save. And he helps them to grow in their faith in the process. If you were to look at your line and you would make a dot on your line that's way kind of down the self end, kind of towards that end, what's probably true is that you have a low level of trust in God. The more you trust him, the more sacrificial you're going to tend to be in the way you live. Do you trust yourself more or do you trust God more? How do we grow in that? I think it's as simple as becoming intimate with Jesus. It's kind of like we live our lives as though we're preparing for a test and Jesus is the subject matter, except we're not trying to get to know facts about Jesus, but rather to know Jesus, the person of Jesus. We invest our time, our study, our preparation, all to become intimate with him. And Joseph's life, I want to close with this, helps us to see Jesus more clearly. Joseph is a type of Christ. He's kind of like a gospel prequel. You can see a little bit of Jesus in Joseph. Think about it. Even though Joseph's brothers sold him out, he responds with grace and forgiveness. Even though we've sold Jesus out, he responds with grace and forgiveness. God has positioned his servant, Joseph, to save, just as God has positioned his servant, Jesus, to save. In the midst of saving his brothers, Joseph was also committed to growing them up in their faith. In the midst of saving us, Jesus wants to grow us toward him from self to sacrifice. In other words, the gospel is the power both to save and to sanctify, to grow us up in holiness. And then one last comparison. Everyone in the whole world was hungry, and they all needed to come to Joseph to get fed. And we're the same way. We're all spiritually hungry. Some of us are here today starving for love, for purpose, for life, for salvation. And in John 6, 35, Jesus said, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger. Whoever believes in me shall never thirst." Jesus is our only hope. He is the only one who provides and sustains. He is the only Savior of the world. Only Jesus can save us, and only Jesus can nourish us. In Romans 5, it says that God demonstrates his love for us. He's trustworthy because of this, that while we were yet sinners, Jesus Christ died for us. Now, why is it that we don't trust in this man, Jesus? Let's pray. God, we are thankful for Joseph. Just in the sense of his story that whatever test we may be going through right now, just watching him handle his life with such strong character and then to see it come full circle down the road, may we just have that perspective that we just trust you completely, knowing that what you're doing is for your glory. We want more and more people to be saved as a result of what you're doing in our lives. Thank you for Jesus, that he is our example in that, that he endured suffering and testing and trial and the cross for us. And that our lives would be like his, that we would endure so that others could be saved. And we thank you in his name. Amen.